This Dharma Talk is brought to you by the Chicago Zen Meditation Community. Learn about us and our teacher, Miyoshi Thompson, at zenchicago.org.
Thanks for your time to talk today. I'm going to try to relate Buddha's birthday to something that we can practice with, because I find that I get more out of our Zen traditions when I have something to hold on to that relates to my own life or something in my own practice that I can work with. And I think that the sort of concept of Buddha is very foreign to me, at least, in terms of like what Buddha is, in terms of how to relate to that kind of practice and what we're really celebrating. Because today, you know, there's stories that Buddha's mother was visited by a dream of a white elephant, that the Buddha was born standing up and was also able to, you know, was almost fully lucid at the time of birth and there was no pain, and water apparently arrived. That's new to me. I also apparently, someone said it was from dragons on the internet. I don't know if that's true either, but you know, there's this really, it's like, you know, there's almost like a superhero feeling to Buddha and the Buddha powers. And it's sort of interesting also because there's so much hierarchy in sort of the Buddhist lineage in different ways. You know, when we talk about our ancestors, we chanted in Shisen, they're all male ancestors as we go through the list. And Buddha is in some ways, you know, also a sort of archetype of sort of like a powerful person. He was like a king's son who was born. He was, you know, leader of a sangha. He was, you know, and it's kind of hard to figure out what we're really celebrating. And so I think there's a lot of choices for what you can celebrate about Buddha. I don't think it's pretty limited. So I'm going to celebrate two things that I think are kind of interesting that affect my practice and are things that are sort of more relevant from my perspective. So the first of them is that Buddha wasn't, in his own words, sort of a god. Buddha was not trying to become something that we would worship or indoctrinate. And so in some ways we have a tradition, but a tradition about someone who didn't want to be dogmatic about that tradition, but at the same time wanted us to experience it. And so I thought I'd read a couple words that are from two different versions of two different parts of the Buddha's own words. These are based out of Old Path White Clouds, which is a Thich Nhat Hanh biography of the Buddha, and I think it's a fun place to start because it's narrative, and so it's an easy way to get a sense of who the Buddha was, which for me is kind of an enjoyable practice from that perspective. So the first two bits that I'm going to read are his thought on what he was. He says, "My teaching is not a dogma or a doctrine, but no doubt some people will take it as such. I must state clearly that my teaching is a method to experience reality and not reality itself. Just as a finger pointing to the moon is not the moon itself, an intelligent person makes use of the finger to see the moon. A person who only looks at the finger and mistakes it for the moon will never see the real moon. My teaching is a means of practice, not something to hold on to or worship. My teaching is like a raft used to cross the river. Only a fool would carry the raft around after he had already reached the other shore, shore of liberation." I connect that to the way we chant the Heart Sutra. When we go through that practice of pouring water over the Buddha's head, I connect that to the sense that you're actually present for the whole time of doing that offering. At each point, you're actually making an offering of your own attention and your own like chanting of the Heart Sutra. And I think there's some, you know, the Heart Sutra is in some ways an anti-dogmatic version of a sutra. It's designing to tell you there are none of those things. You can't hold on to them. And as you go through, you know, and what's left is your attention and your presence after you go through those. And so I don't think what the Buddha was doing from that perspective was sort of aggrandizing himself, even though that's what we celebrate the Buddha. I don't think that was part of what what it was, and there's an almost indelible feeling of individual relationships that the Buddha leaves. Like the words are, the feeling is that there's a connection directly between you and the Dharma, and the Buddha sort of created that connection by showing some balance with respect to those things. Some other words that I found very meaningful for his are, noble son, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. Why so? A bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that he causes the development of living beings. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that through the entrance into a Buddha field, living beings are introduced to the Buddha gnosis. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that through entrance into that Buddha field, living beings increase their noble spiritual faculties. Why so, noble son? A Buddha field of bodhisattvas springs from the aims of living beings. So one thing I really take from many of his comments is every moment can be a spiritual moment, and all the different people you practice with can be people who are teachers, and they're also part of the path. They might be in different lives, or bodhisattvas of different lives, but at the same time, they're all present. And he was very good about making sure that that was what was left. He was not, you know, he didn't leave with instructions that it was not a living, breathing kind of sangha. He had developed a set of rules for that, so that when he left and passed on, and he didn't stay forever, although it's unclear. I think he could have survived 10 more years if he'd just been asked, I think, is one of the things that had occurred. So one of the things I really take from that is that when we celebrate Buddha's life or death, there's a chance for an individual relationship with the Dharma, and that he's sort of showing us how, versus being a sort of icon of those things. The other one that I really connect with when I celebrate Buddha is his sense of diversity, which is a funny thing to say. I hunted up the recent statistics on Buddhism and who is Buddhist, and this is from the Pew Foundation. And it turns out that 27% of Buddhists in America have graduate degrees, which is 11% higher than the standard population. And that's certainly borne out by our Sangha in different ways. 81% of Buddhists identify as white, which is much higher than the national average. And 61% of us prioritize environmental protection over economic growth, according to the most, they're apparently using this for voting data. And then the survey said it was gender balanced, but the practice seems to be skewed, if you look at the numbers, by the ethnicity of the people who are practicing. So from a white perspective, it's a little more male. And, you know, so celebrating Buddha's life is funny, because in some ways you could take it as, let's celebrate the original male person in a lineage of people who were, you know, in some ways privileged. I mean, the Buddha was the son of a king and for the first part of his life was not really given access to any of the sufferings of the world, particularly because of what his father was doing. And, you know, but from my perspective, what the Buddha left us with was very different than that legacy, in the sense that there's a chance to be more inclusive. And I know it's a little bit, it's a little mixed. I know that the Buddha also had a period where basically his aunt wanted to be practice, and he wasn't sure his aunt could practice. So I know there's more to it. But I want to leave you with a longer passage from the Old Path White Clouds, which I think is really meaningful. And it talks about what it means to be connected to the Buddha for an individual who is the narrator of a big section of that book. And that narrator is a untouchable in the Indian caste system, which is a very different gulf from the Brahmins, which were a much higher caste. And so one of the things I take from Buddha's birth is a chance to sort of broaden ourselves and broaden our community and broaden our investment in those things. Because I think he was, in some ways, one of the original people who gave us a chance to all practice together in a sort of harmonious and equal way. A lot of his teachings were about how we can do this in an inclusive fashion. And often, I was just reading a little bit of the Vimalakirti Sutra, and he points to a layperson as one of the people who is, you know, most evolved in their practice. Like, it doesn't mean that there is any particular set of requirements. He really went through the practice that everyone can practice and join the community to a large degree. So here's a little bit that I'm going to read. Many bhikkhus were of noble birth, such as the venerable Nanda.
Could you read a little slower?
Sure. Many bhikkhus were of noble birth, such as the venerable Nanda, the Buddha's brother, and Devadatta, Anuranda, and Ananda. Although Savaste had not yet been introduced to these men, he had noticed them from afar. Even in faded robes, their noble bearing was unmistakable. It will be a long time before I can be friends with men of such noble birth, thought Savasti. And that even though the Buddha himself was the son of a king, Savasti felt no gulf between them. Savasti was an untouchable, lower than the lowest and poorest caste according to the system of discrimination amongst the people of India at the time. For more than 10 years, we had tended to water buffalo, but for 2 weeks now, he was living and practicing with monks from all castes. Everyone was kind to him, offering him warm smiles and deep bows, but he did not yet feel at ease. He suspected it might take years before he could feel completely comfortable. Suddenly, a broad smile emerged from deep within him as he thought of Rahula, the Buddha's 18-year-old son. Rahula had been a novice in the community since the age of 10. In just 2 weeks, Rahula and Savasti had become best friends. It was Rahula who understood the Buddha's teachings well, even though he was not yet a bhikkhu. He needed to wait till he was ordained. Savasti did not belong to any of the four social castes. His father had explained to him that the Brahmin caste was the highest, and people born into castes were priests and teachers who read and understood the Vedas and other scriptures and made offerings to the gods. When Brahma created the human race, the Brahmin issued from his mouth. The Kshatriya were the next highest class. They could hold political and military possessions as they'd issued from the Brahma's two hands. Those of the Vaisaya caste were merchants, farmers, and craftspeople who had sprung from Brahma's thighs. Those of the Sudra caste had come from the Brahma's feet and were the lowest of the four castes. They did not only manual labor, was not performed by the higher castes, but Savasti's families were untouchables, those who had no caste at all. They were required to build their homes outside the village limits, and they did the lowest kind of work, such as collecting garbage, spreading manure, digging roads, feeding pigs, and tending water buffaloes. The sacred scriptures taught that happiness was the ability to accept one's position. When Savasti met the Buddha, the Buddha slowly patted Savasti on the head. No one had ever touched him on the head in so gentle and affectionate way, and yet he suddenly felt panic-stricken. "Don't be afraid, child," the man said in a quiet and reassuring voice. At the sound of that voice, Savasti's fears disappeared. He lifted his head and gazed at the man's kind and tolerant smile. After hesitating for a moment, he stammered, "Sir, I like you very much." The man lifted Savasti's chin in his hand and looked into the boy's eyes. "And I like you also. Do you live nearby?" Savasti did not answer. He took the man's hand in his own hand, two hands, and asked the question that was troubling him. "When I touch you like this, aren't you being polluted?" The man laughed and shook his head. "Not at all, child. You are a human being, and I am a human being. You can't pollute me. Don't listen to what people tell you." He took Savasti's hand and walked into the edge of the forest. The water buffaloes were still grazing peacefully. The man looked at Savasti and asked, "Do you tend these waterfalls? And that must be the grass you cut for their dinner. What is your name?" Savasti offered Siddhartha an armful of kusa grass to use as a cushion for meditation. So, it's hard to know exactly what to do with that kind of almost game-changing openness, which I understand is a story of a story of a story. But it appears to me that as we think through what that means for Buddha's birth, maybe there are small ways we can do it in everyday life. One occurred to me, which is funny, which is there's something that's come up in the Sangha, which is that when we do our talks, people in the little blue robes speak first. But all the people in the little blue robes speak first because they just want to make sure someone speaks. So it turns out we're all a little backwards, trying to take care of each other. But the point is, there's no hierarchy here from that perspective. And the point is, it's a place of practice, I think, where we get a chance to be in real touch with our own sense of Dharma, and also with the Dharma of others around us and our teachers. And having a chance to sort of honor your teacher from that perspective, I think is a meaningful part of the practice. And so I guess my question for today is, are there pieces of the Buddha story that you really connect with? And did any of the ones that I raise strike you as something that you can connect with too, as we think about what the Buddha's life means to us 2,500 years later?